"Winded," he said. "I've talked away our time and haven't given you anything of use."
"Just the history makes a great difference," I said gratefully.
"Are you sure I can't interest you in a few stories from other families?" he asked, walking over to a work table. "I wintered with the Jackis family not long ago. The Baron is a widower, you know, quite wealthy and somewhat eccentric."
He raised both eyebrows at me, his eyes wide with implied scandal.
"I'm sure I could remember a few interesting things if I were assured of my anonymity."
I was tempted to break character for that, but instead I shook my head.
"Perhaps when I'm done working on the Lackless section," I said with all the self-importance of someone devoted to a truly useless project. "My research is quite delicate. I don't want to get tangled up in my head."
Cauticus frowned a bit, then shrugged it away as he rolled up his sleeves and began to make the mayor's medicine. I watched him go through his preparations again. It wasn't alchemy. I knew that from watching Simon work. This was barely even chemistry. Mixing a medicine like this was closer to following a recipe than anything, but what were the ingredients? I watched him move through it step by step. The dried leaf was probably bite-few. The liquid from the stoppered jar was no doubt moratum or aquafortis, some sort of acid at any rate. When it bubbled and steamed in the lead bowl, it dissolved a small amount of lead, maybe only a quarter scruple. The white powder was probably the ophalum. He added a pinch of the final ingredient. I couldn't even guess what that was. It looked like salt, but then again, most everything looks like salt. As he went through the motions, Cauticus nattered on about court gossip. Defer's eldest son had broken his leg jumping out a brothel window. Lady Hesua's most recent lover was Yilish and didn't speak a word of Aeturin. There was a rumor of highwaymen on the king's road to the north, but there are always rumors of bandits, so that was nothing new. I don't care one whit for gossip, but I can fake interest when I must. All the while I watched Cauticus for some telltale sign, some whisper of nervousness, a bead of sweat, a moment's hesitation, but there was nothing. Not the slightest indication he was preparing a poison for the mayor. He was perfectly comfortable, utterly at ease. Was it possible he was poisoning the mayor by accident? Impossible. Any arcanist worth his guilder knew enough chemistry to... Then it dawned on me. Maybe Cauticus wasn't an arcanist at all. Maybe he was simply a man in a dark robe who didn't know the difference between an alligator and a crocodile. Maybe he was just a clever pretender who happened to be poisoning the mayor out of simple ignorance. Maybe that was peach brandy in his distillery. He tamped the cork into the vial of amber liquid and handed it to me.
"There you are," he said. "Make sure you take it to him straight away. It will be best if he gets it while it's still warm."
The temperature of a medicine doesn't make one whit of difference. Any physicker knows that. I took the vial and pointed to his chest as if I just noticed something. "My word, is that an amulet?" He seemed confused at first, and then drew out the leather cord from underneath his robes.
"Of sorts," he said with a tolerant smile.
At a casual glance, the piece of lead he wore around his neck looked very much like an Arcanum guilder.
"Does it protect you from spirits?" I asked in a hushed voice.
"Oh, yes," he said flippantly. "All sorts."
I swallowed nervously.
"May I touch it?"
He shrugged and leaned forward, holding it out to me. I took it timidly with my thumb and forefinger, then jumped back a step.
"It bit me!"
I said, pitching my voice somewhere between indignation and anxiety as I wrung my hand. I saw him fighting down a smile.
"Ah, yes. I need to feed it, I suspect."
He tucked it back inside his robes.
"Go on now."
He made a shooing motion toward the door. I made my way back to the mayor's rooms, trying to massage some feeling back into my numb fingers. It was a genuine Arcanum guilder. He was a real arcanist. He knew exactly what he was doing. I returned to the mayor's rooms and engaged in 5 minutes of painfully formal small talk while I refilled the Flitz feeders with the still warm medicine. The birds were unnervingly energetic, humming and chirruping sweetly. The mayor sipped a cup of tea as we talked, his eyes following me quietly from the bed. When my work with the birds was finished, I made my goodbyes and left as quickly as propriety allowed. Though our conversation hadn't touched on anything more serious than the weather, I could read his underlying message as plainly as if he'd written it for me to read. He was in control. He was keeping his options open. He didn't trust me. Chapter 63, The Gilded Cage. After my brief taste of freedom, I was trapped in my rooms again. Though I hoped the mayor was through the worst of his recovery, I still needed to be at hand, should his condition worsen and he call on me. I couldn't justify even a brief trip to Severin Low, no matter how desperately I wanted to head back to Tinnery Street with the hope of meeting up with Denna. So, I called on Braden and spent a pleasant afternoon playing tack. We played game after game, and I lost each one in new and exciting ways. This time, when we parted ways, he left the game table with me, claiming his servants were tired of carrying it back and forth between our rooms. In addition to tack with Braden and my music, I had a new distraction, albeit an irritating one. Cauticus was every bit the gossip he seemed to be, and word had spread about my story genealogy. So now, in addition to courtiers trying to pry information out of me, I was deluged with a steady flow of people eager to air everyone else's dirty laundry. I dissuaded those I could, and encouraged the especially rabid to write their stories down and send them to me. A surprising number of them took time to do this, and a stack of slanderous stories began to accumulate on a desk in one of my unused rooms. The next day, when the mayor summoned me, I arrived to find Alvaron sitting in a chair near his bed, reading a copy of Fiorin's Claim of Kings in the original Eld Vintic. His color was remarkably good, and I saw no trembling in his hands as he turned a page. He didn't look up as I entered the room. Without speaking, I prepared a new pot of tea with the hot water waiting at the mayor's bedside table. I poured a cup and set it at the table by his elbow. I checked the gilded cage in his sitting room. The flits darted back and forth to the feeders, playing dizzying aerial games which made them difficult to count. Still, I was reasonably certain there were 12 of them. They seemed none the worse despite 3 days of poisonous diet. I resisted an urge to knock the cage about a bit. Finally, I replaced the mayor's flask of cod liver oil and found it was still 3/4 full. Yet another sign of my fading credibility. Wordlessly, I gathered up my things and prepared to leave, but before I made it to the door, the mayor turned his eyes up from his book. "Quoth?" "Yes, Your Grace?" "It seems I'm not as thirsty as I thought. Would you mind finishing this for me?" He gestured to the untasted cup of tea that sat on the table. "To Your Grace's health," I said, and drank a sip. I made a face and added a spoon of sugar, stirred, and drained the rest of it with the mayor watching me. His eyes were calm, clever, and too knowing to be wholly good. Cauticus let me in and ushered me into the same seat as before.
"You'll excuse me for a moment," he said. "I have an experiment I must attend to, or I fear it will be ruined."
He hurried up a set of steps that led to a different part of the tower. With nothing else to occupy my attention, I eyed his display of rings again, realizing that a person could make a fair guess at his position in the court by using the rings themselves as triangulation points. Cauticus returned just as I was idly considering stealing one of his gold rings.
"I was not sure if you wanted your rings back," Cauticus said, gesturing.
I looked back at the table and saw them resting on a tray. It seemed odd I hadn't noticed them before. I picked them up and slid them into an inner pocket of my cloak.
"Thank you kindly," I said. "And will you be taking the mayor his medicine again today?" he asked.
I nodded, puffing myself up proudly. When I nodded, the motion of my head made me dizzy. It was only then I realized the trouble. I'd drunk a full cup of the mayor's tea. There hadn't been much laudanum in it. Or rather, not much laudanum if you are in pain and being slowly weaned away from a budding addiction to Ophalum. However, it was quite a bit of laudanum for someone like myself. I could feel the effects of it slowly creeping over me. A warm lassitude running through my bones. Everything seemed to be moving a little more slowly than normal.
"The mayor seemed eager for his medicine today," I said, taking extra care to speak clearly. "I'm afraid I don't have much time to chat."
I was in no condition to play the half-wit gentry for any length of time. Cotticus nodded seriously and retreated to his work table. I followed him as I always did, wearing my best curious expression. I watched with half an eye as Cotticus mixed the medicine, but my wits were fuddled by the laudanum, and what remained were focused on other matters. The mayor was hardly speaking to me. Stapes hadn't trusted me from the beginning, and the flits were healthy as ever. Worst of all, I was trapped in my rooms while Denna waited down on Tinnery Street, no doubt wondering why I hadn't come to visit. I looked up, aware that Cotticus had asked me a question.
"Beg your pardon?
Could you pass me the acid?" Cotticus repeated as he finished measuring out a portion of leaf into his mortar and pestle. I picked up the glass decanter and began to hand it to him before I remembered I was just an ignorant lordling. I couldn't tell salt from sulfur. I didn't even know what an acid was. I did not flush or stumble. I didn't sweat or stutter. I am a Dima Rue born, and even drugged and fuddled, I am a performer down to the marrow of my bones. I met his eyes and asked, "This one, right? The clear bottle comes next." Cotticus gave me a long, speculative look. I flashed him a brilliant grin.
"I've got a good eye for detail," I said smugly. "I've watched you go through this twice now. I bet I could mix the mayor's medicine myself if I wanted to."
I pitched my voice with all the ignorant self-confidence I could muster. This is the true mark of nobility, the unshakable belief that they can do anything, tan leather, shoe a horse, spin pottery, plow a field, if they really wanted to. Cotticus looked at me a moment longer, then began to measure out the acid.
"I dare say you could, young sir."
3 minutes later, I was walking down the hall with the warm vial of medicine in my sweaty palm. It almost didn't matter whether I'd fooled him or not. What mattered was that for some reason, Cotticus was suspicious of me. Stapes stared daggers into my back as he let me into the mayor's rooms. And Alvaron ignored me as I poured the new dose of poison into the flit's feeders. The pretty things hummed about their cage with infuriating energy. I took the long way back to my rooms, trying to get a better feel for the layout of the mayor's estate. I already had my escape route half planned, but Cotticus's suspicion encouraged me to put the finishing touches on it. If the flits didn't start dying tomorrow, it would probably be in my best interest to disappear from Severin as quickly and quietly as possible. Late that night, when I was reasonably sure the mayor wouldn't call on me, I slipped out the window of my room and made a thorough exploration of the gardens. There were no guards this late at night, but I did have to avoid a half-dozen couples taking moonlight strolls. There were two others sitting in close, romantic conversation, one in a bower, the other in a gazebo. The last couple I nearly trod on while cutting through a hedgerow. They were neither strolling nor conversing in any conventional sense, but their activities were romantic. They didn't notice me. Eventually, I found my way onto the roof. From there, I could see the grounds surrounding the estate. The western edge was out of the question, of course, as it was pressed up against the edge of the shear, but I knew there had to be other opportunities for escape. While exploring the southern end of the estate, I saw lights burning brightly in one of the towers. What's more, they had the distinctive red tint of sympathy lamps. Cotticus was still awake. I made my way over and risked a look inside, peering down into the tower. Cotticus was not simply working late. He was talking to someone. I craned my neck, but I couldn't see who he was speaking to. What's more, the window was leaded shut, and I couldn't hear anything. I was about to move to a different window when Codicus stood and began to walk to the door. The other person came into view, and even from this steep angle I could recognize the portly, unassuming figure of Stapes. Stapes was clearly worked up about something. He made an emphatic gesture with one hand, his face deathly serious. Codicus nodded several times in agreement before opening the door to let the manservant out. I noted Stapes wasn't carrying anything when he left. He hadn't stopped by for medicine. He hadn't stopped by to borrow a book. Stapes had stopped by in the middle of the night to have a private conversation with the man who was trying to kill the mayor. Chapter 64. Flight. Though no family can boast a truly peaceful past, the Lacklesses have been especially ripe with misfortune. Some from without, assassination, invasion, peasant revolt, and theft. More telling is misfortune that comes from within. How can a family thrive when the eldest heir forsakes all family duty? Small wonder they are often called the luckless by their detractors. It seems a testament to the strength of their blood that they have survived so much for so long. Indeed, if not for the burning of Caleptina, we might possess records tracing the Lacklesse family back far enough for them to rival the royal line of Modeg in its antiquity. I tossed the book onto the table in a way that would have made Master Lawrence spit blood. If the mayor thought this sort of information was enough to woo a woman, he was in worse need of my help than he thought. But as things currently stood, I doubted the mayor would be asking me for any help with anything, least of all something as sensitive as his courting. Yesterday, he hadn't summoned me to his rooms at all. I was clearly out of favor, and I sensed Stapes had a hand in it. Given what I had seen 2 nights ago in Codicus's tower, it was fairly obvious Stapes was part of the conspiracy to poison the mayor. Though it meant spending all day trapped in my rooms, I stayed where I was. I knew better than to jeopardize Alvaron's already low opinion of me by approaching him without being summoned first. An hour before lunch, Viscount Gurman stopped by my rooms with a few pages of handwritten gossip. He also brought a deck of cards, apparently thinking to take a page from Braden's book. He offered to teach me how to play thrush, and, as I was just learning the game, agreed to play for the pittance of a single silver bit per hand. He made the mistake of letting me deal, and left in a bit of a huff after I won 18 hands in a row. I suppose I could have been more subtle. I could have played him like a fish on a line and bilked him for half his estate, but I was in no mood for it. My thoughts were not pleasant, and I preferred to be alone with them. An hour after lunch, I decided I was no longer interested in currying favor with the mayor. If Alvaron wished to trust his treacherous manservant, that was his business. I'd be damned if I would spend one more minute sitting idle in my room, waiting by the door like a whipped dog. I threw on my cloak, grabbed my loot case, and decided to take a walk down Tinnery Street. If the mayor needed me while I was away, he could damn well leave a note. I was halfway into the hall when I saw the guard standing at attention outside my door. He was one of Alvaron's own, clad in sapphire and ivory. We stood for a moment, motionless. There was no sense in asking if he was there on my account. Mine was the only door for 20 feet in any direction. I met his eye. "And you are?"
"Jay, sir."
At least I still rated a sir. That was worth something. "And you're here because?"
"I'm to accompany you if you leave your room, sir."
"Right." I stepped back into my room and closed the door behind me. Were his orders from Alvaron or Stapes? It didn't really matter. I went out my window into the garden, over the little streamlet, behind a hedgerow, and up a section of decorative stone wall. My burgundy cloak was not the best color for sneaking around in the garden, but it worked quite nicely against the red of the roofing tiles. After that, I made my way onto the roof of the stables, through a hayloft, and out the back door of a disused barn. From there, it was just a matter of jumping a fence, and I was off the mayor's estate. Simple. I stopped at 12 inns on Tinnery Street before I found the one where Denna was staying. She wasn't there, so I continued along the street, keeping my eyes open and trusting to my luck. I spotted her an hour later. She was standing at the edge of a crowd, watching a street corner production of, believe it or not, Three Pennies for Wishing. Her skin was darker than when I'd seen her last at the university, tanned from travel, and she wore a high-necked dress after the local fashion. Her dark hair fell in a straight sheaf across her back, all except a single slender braid that hung close to her face. I caught her eye just as Dead Nettle shouted out his first line in the play.
"I've cures for what ails you. My wares never fails you. I've potions for pennies, results guaranteed. So if you've got a dicky heart, or can't get her legs apart, come straight away to my cart. You'll find what you need."
Denna smiled when she saw me. We might have stayed for the play, but I already knew the ending. Hours later, Denna and I were eating sweet vintage grapes in the shadow of the sheer. Some industrious stonemason had carved a shallow niche into the white stone of the cliff, making smooth seats of stone. It was a cozy place we had discovered while walking aimlessly through the city. We were alone, and I felt myself to be the luckiest man in the world. My only regret was that I didn't have her ring with me. It would have been the perfect unexpected gift to go with our unexpected meeting. Worse yet, I couldn't even tell Denna about it. If I did, I'd be forced to admit I'd used it as collateral for my loan with Davy.
"You seem to be doing fairly well for yourself," Denna said, rubbing the edge of my burgundy cloak between her fingers. "Have you given up the bookish life?"
"Taking a vacation," I hedged. "Right now, I'm assisting the Mayor Alvaron with a thing or two." Her eyes widened appreciatively.
"Do tell."
I looked away uncomfortably. "I'm afraid I can't. Delicate matters and all that." I cleared my throat and tried to change the subject. "What of you? You seem to be doing fairly well yourself." I brushed two fingers across the embroidery that decorated the high neck of her dress.
"Well, I'm not rubbing elbows with the mayor," she said, making an exaggerated deferential gesture in my direction. "But, as I mention in my letters, I..."
"Letters?" I asked. "You sent more than one?"
She nodded. "Three since I left," she said. "I was about to start a fourth, but you've saved me the trouble."
"I only got the one," I said. Denna shrugged.
"I'd rather tell you in person anyway."
She paused dramatically.
"I finally have my formal patronage."
"You have?" I said, delighted. "Denna, that's wonderful news!" Denna grinned proudly. Her teeth were white against the light nut color of her travel-tanned face. Her lips, as always, were red without the aid of any paint.
"Is he part of the court here in Severin?" I asked. "What's his name?"
Denna's grin faded into a serious look, a confused smile playing around her mouth.
"You know I can't tell you that," she chided. "You know how closely he guards his privacy."
My excitement fell away, leaving me cold.
"Oh, no.
Denna, it's not the same fellow as before, is it? The one who sent you to play for that wedding in Traben?" Denna looked puzzled.
"Of course it is. I can't tell you his real name. What was it you called him before? Master Elm?"
"Master Ash," I said, and it felt like a mouthful of ashes when I said it.
"Do you at least know his real name? Did he tell you that much before you signed up?"
"I expect I know his real name," she shrugged, running a hand through her hair. When her fingers touched the braid, she seemed surprised to find it there and quickly began to unravel it, her deft fingers smoothing it away.
"Even if I don't, what does it matter? Everyone has secrets, Quoth. I don't particularly care what his are so long as he continues to deal square with me. He's been very generous."
"He's not just secretive, Denna," I protested. "From the way you've described him, I'd say he's either paranoid or tangled up in dangerous business."
"I don't know why you're carrying such a grudge against him."
I couldn't believe she could say that.
"Denna, he beat you senseless."
She went very still.
No.
Her hand went to the fading bruise on her cheek.
No, he didn't. I told you. I fell while I was out riding. The stupid horse couldn't tell a stick from a snake.
I shook my head.
I'm talking about last fall in Traben.
Denna's hand fell back to her lap where it made an absent-minded fidgeting gesture, trying to toy with a ring that wasn't there. She looked at me, her expression blank.
How did you know about that?
You told me yourself. That night on the hill, waiting for the Drakus to come? She looked down, blinking.
I don't remember saying that.
You were a little addled at the time, I said gently.
But you did.
You told me all about it.
Denna, you shouldn't have to stay with someone like that. Anyone who could do that to you...
He did it for my own good, she said, her dark eyes beginning to flicker with anger.
Did I tell you that?
There I was without a scratch on me, and everyone else at the wedding dead as leather. You know what small towns are like. Even after they found me unconscious, they thought I might have had something to do with it.
You remember?
I put my head down and shook it like an ox worrying its yoke. I don't believe it. There had to be another way around the situation. I would have found another way.
Well, I guess we can't all be as clever as you, she said.
Clever doesn't have anything to do with it. I came close to shouting. He could have taken you away with him. He could have come forward and vouched for you.
He couldn't let anyone know he was there, Denna said.
He said he beat you.
And as I spoke the words, I felt a terrible anger come together inside me. It wasn't hot and furious, as some of my flashes of temper tend to be. This was different, slow and cold. And as soon as I felt it, I realized it had been there inside me for a long while, crystallizing, like a pond slowly freezing solid over a long winter night.
He beat you, I said again, and I could feel it inside, a solid block of icy anger. Nothing you can say will change that, and if I ever see him, I'll likely stick a knife in him rather than shake his hand.
Denna looked up at me then, the irritation fading from her face. She gave me a look that was all sweet fondness and mingled pity. It was the sort of look you give a puppy when it growls, thinking itself terribly fierce. She put her hand gently on the side of my face, and I felt myself flush hot and hard, suddenly embarrassed by my own melodrama. "Can we not argue about it?" she asked. "Please? Not today. It's been so long since I've seen you."
I decided to let it go rather than risk driving her away. I knew what happened when men pressed her too hard.
Fair enough, I said. For today. Can you at least tell me what sort of thing your patron brought you out here for?
Denna leaned back in her seat, smiling a wide smile.
Sorry. Delicate matters and all that, she mimicked.
Don't be that way, I protested. I'd tell you if I could, but the mayor values his privacy very highly.
Denna leaned forward again to lay her hand over mine. Poor Kvothe. It's not out of spite. My patron is at least as private as the mayor. He made it very clear that things would go badly if I ever made our relationship public. He was quite emphatic about it.
Her expression had gone serious.
He's a powerful man.
She seemed as if she would say more, then stopped herself. Though I didn't want to, I understood. My recent brush with the mayor's anger had taught me caution.
What can you tell me about him?
Denna tapped a finger against her lips thoughtfully.
He's a surprisingly good dancer. I think I can say that without betraying anything. He's quite graceful, she said, then laughed at my expression. I'm doing some research for him, looking into old genealogies and histories. He's helping me write a couple songs so I can make a name for myself.
She hesitated, then shook her head.
I think that's all I can say.
Will I get to hear the songs after you're done? She gave a shy smile.
I think that can be arranged.
She leapt to her feet and grabbed my arm to pull me to my feet.
Enough talking. Come and walk with me.
I smiled, her enthusiasm as infectious as a child's. But when she pulled at my hand, she let out a tiny yelp, flinching, and pressing one of her hands to her side. I was standing next to her in a second. "What's the matter?" Denna shrugged and gave me a brittle smile, holding her arm close to her ribs. "My fall," she said. "That stupid horse. I get a twinge when I forget and move too quickly." "Has anyone looked at it?" "It's just a bruise," she said. "And the sort of doctor I can afford, I wouldn't trust to touch me." "What of your patron?" I asked. "Certainly he could arrange something." She slowly straightened. "It's really not a problem." She lifted her arms above her head and made a quick, clever dance step, then laughed at my serious expression. "No more talk of secret things for now. Come, walk with me. Tell me dark and lurid gossip from the mayor's court." "Very well," I said as we began to walk. "I've heard the mayor is marvelously recovered from a long-standing illness." "You're a poor rumor-monger," she said. "Everyone knows that. The Baronet Bramston played a disastrous deck of faro last night." Denna rolled her eyes. "Boring." "The Comtesse de Fer lost her virginity while attending a performance of Deonica."
"Oh!"
Denna raised her hand to her mouth, stifling a laugh.
"Did she really?"
"She certainly didn't have it with her after the intermission," I said in a hushed voice. "But it turns out she had just left it behind in her rooms, so it was merely misplaced, not really lost. The servants found it 2 days later when they were cleaning up. Turns out it had rolled underneath a chest of drawers." Denna's expression turned indignant.
"I can't believe I believed you."
She swatted at me, then grimaced again, sucking a sharp breath through her teeth. "You know," I said softly, "I've been trained at the university. I'm not a physicker, but the medicine I know is good. I could take a look at it for you." She gave me a long look, as if she wasn't quite sure what to make of my offer. "I think," she said at last, "that might be the most circumspect route anyone has ever tried for getting me out of my clothes."
I
felt myself blush furiously. "I didn't mean..." Denna laughed at my discomfiture. "If I let anyone play doctor with me, it would be you, my quoth," she said. "But I'll tend to it for now." She linked arms with me and we continued our walk down the street. "I know enough to take care of myself." I returned to the mayor's estate hours later, taking the direct route rather than come in over the rooftops. When I arrived in the hallway leading to my room, I found two guards standing there instead of the single one that had been waiting before. I guessed they had discovered my escape. Even this couldn't dampen my spirits overmuch, as the time I'd spent with Denna had left me feeling 12 feet tall. Better yet, I was meeting with her tomorrow to go riding. Having a specific time and place to meet was an unexpected treat where Denna was concerned. "Good evening, gentlemen," I said as I came down the hall. "Anything interesting happen while I was out?"
"You're to be confined to your rooms," Jay said grimly.
I noticed he left off the "sir" this time. I paused with my hand on the doorknob. "Beg pardon?"
"You're to remain in your rooms until we get further orders," he said, "and one of us is to stay with you at all times."
I felt my temper flare up.
"And does Alvaron know about this?" I asked sharply.
They looked at each other uncertainly. It was Stapes giving the orders then. That uncertainty would be enough to keep them from laying hands on me.
"Let's get this sorted out straight away," I said, and started down the hall at a brisk walk, leaving the guards to catch up with me, their armor clattering. My temper fanned itself hotter as I made my way through the halls. If my credibility with the mayor was truly ruined, I preferred to have it done with now. If I couldn't have the mayor's goodwill, I would at least have my freedom and the ability to see Denna when I wished. I turned the corner just in time to see the mayor emerging from his rooms. He looked as healthy as I had ever seen him, carrying a sheaf of papers under one arm. As I approached, irritation flashed across his face, and I thought he might simply have the guards carry me away. Nevertheless,
I approached him as boldly as if I had a written invitation.
"Your Grace," I said with cheery cordiality. "Might we talk for a moment?"
"Certainly," he replied in a similar tone as he swung open the door he had been about to close behind himself.
"Do come in."
I watched his eyes and saw an anger as hot as mine. A small, sensible part of me quailed, but my temper had the bit in its teeth and was galloping madly ahead. We left the bemused guards in the antechamber, and Alvaron led me through the second set of doors into his personal rooms. Silence hung dangerous in the air, like the calm before a sudden summer storm.
"I cannot believe your impudence," the mayor hissed once the doors were closed. "Your wild accusations, your ridiculous claims. I mislike public unpleasantness, so we will deal with this later."
He made an imperious gesture.
"Return to your rooms, and do not leave until I decide how best to deal with you.
Your Grace," I could tell by the set of his shoulders that he was ready to call the guards.
"I do not hear you," he said flatly.
He met my gaze then. His eyes were hard as flint, and I saw how angry he truly was. This wasn't the anger of a patron or employer. It wasn't someone irritated by my failure to respect the social order. This was a man who had ruled everything around him from the age of 16. This man thought nothing of hanging someone from an iron gibbet to make a point. This was a man who, but for a twist of history, would now be king of all Vintus. My temper sputtered and went out like a snuffed candle, leaving me chilled. I realized then that I had misjudged my situation badly. When I was a child, homeless on the streets of Tarbian, I'd learned to deal with dangerous people, drunken dock workers, guardsmen, even a homeless child with a bottle glass knife can kill you. The key to staying safe was knowing the rules of the situation. A guard wouldn't beat you in the middle of the street. A dock worker wouldn't chase you if you ran. Now, with sudden clarity, I realized my mistake. The mayor was not bound by any rules. He could order me killed, then hang my body over the city gates. He could throw me in jail and forget about me. He could leave me there while I grew starved and sickly. I had no position, no friends to intercede on my behalf. I was helpless as a child with a willow switch sword. I realized this in a flash and felt a gnawing fear settle in my belly. I should have stayed in Severin Low while I had the chance. I never should have come here in the first place and meddled in the affairs of powerful folk such as this. It was just then that Stapes bustled in from the mayor's dressing room. Seeing us, his normally placid expression flickered briefly into panic and surprise. He recovered quickly.
"I beg your pardon, sirs," he said, and hurried back the way he came.
"Stapes," the mayor called out before he could leave, "come here." Stapes slunk back into the room. He wrung his hands nervously. His face had the stricken look of a guilty man, a man caught in the midst of something dishonest. Alvaron's voice was stern. "Stapes, what do you have there?" Looking closer, I saw the manservant wasn't wringing his hands. He was clutching something.
"It's nothing."
"Stapes!" the mayor barked. "How dare you lie to me! Show me at once!" Numbly, the portly manservant opened his hands. A tiny gem-bright bird lay lifeless on his palm. His face had lost all hint of color. Never in the history of the world has the death of a lovely thing brought such relief and joy. I had been certain of Stapes's betrayal for days now, and here was the unquestionable proof of it. Nevertheless, I kept quiet. The mayor had to see this with his own eyes. "What is the meaning of this?" the mayor asked slowly.
"It's not good to think of such things, sir," the manservant said quickly. "And worse to dwell on them. I'll just fetch another one. It'll sing just as sweet."
There was a long pause. I could see Alvaron struggling to contain the rage he'd been ready to unleash on me. The silence continued to stretch.
"Stapes," I said slowly, "how many birds have you replaced these last few days?"
Stapes turned to me, his expression indignant. Before he could speak, the mayor broke in.
"Answer him, Stapes."
His voice sounded almost choked.
"Has there been more than this one?"
Stapes gave the mayor a stricken look.
"Oh, Rand, I didn't want to trouble you. You were so bad for a time. Then you asked for the birds and had that terrible night. Then the next day one of them died."
Looking down at the tiny bird in his hand, his words came faster and faster, almost tumbling over each other, too clumsy to be anything but sincere.
"I didn't want to fill your head with talk of dying things, so I snuck it out and bought in a new one. Then you kept getting better and they started falling 4 or 5 a day. Every time I looked, there would be another one lying in the bottom of the cage like a little cut flower, but you were doing so well, I didn't want to mention it."
Stapes covered the dead Sipquick with a cupped hand.
"It's like they were giving up their little souls to make you well again."
Something inside the man suddenly gave way, and he began to cry. The deep, hopeless sobs of an honest man who had been frightened and helpless for a long time watching the slow death of a well-loved friend. Elveron stood motionless for a stunned moment, all the anger spilling out of him. Then he moved to put his arms gently around his manservant.
"Oh, Stapes," he said softly. "They were, in a way. You haven't done anything you can be blamed for."
I quietly left the room and busied myself removing the feeders from the gilded cage. An hour later, the three of us were eating a quiet supper together in the mayor's rooms. Elveron and I told Stapes what had been happening over the last several days. Stapes was almost giddy, both at his master's health and at the knowledge it would continue to improve. As for myself, after suffering a few days under Alvaron's displeasure, being so suddenly in his good graces again was a relief. Nevertheless, I was shaken by how close to disaster I had been. I was honest with the mayor about my misguided suspicion of Stapes, and I offered the manservant my sincere apology. Stapes, in turn, admitted his doubts about me. In the end, we shook hands and thought much better of each other. As we were chatting over the last bits of supper, Stapes perked up, excused himself, and hurried out.
"My outer door," the mayor explained. "He has ears like a dog. It's uncanny."
Stapes opened the door to admit the tall man with the shaven head who had been looking over maps with Alvaron when I'd first arrived, Commander Dagon. As Dagon stepped into the room, his eyes flicked to each of the corners, to the window, to the door, briefly over me, then back to the mayor. When his eyes touched me, all the deep feral instincts that had kept me alive on the streets of Tarbian told me to run, hide, do anything so long as it took me far away from this man.
"Ah, Dagon," the mayor said cheerily. "Are you well this fine day?"
"Yes, Your Grace."
He stood attentively, not quite meeting the mayor's eye.
"Would you be good enough to arrest Corticus for treason?"
There was a half-heartbeat pause.
"Yes, Your Grace."
8 men should be sufficient, providing they are not likely to panic in a complicated situation."
"Yes, Your Grace."
I began to sense subtle differences in Dagon's responses.
"Alive," Alvaron responded, as if answering a question. "But you needn't be gentle."
"Yes, Your Grace."
With that, Dagon turned to leave. I spoke up quickly.
"Your Grace, if he's truly an arcanist, you ought to take certain precautions."
I regretted the word "ought" as soon as I had said it. "Ought" was presumptuous. I should have said, "You may wish to consider taking certain precautions." Alvaron seemed to take no notice of my misstep.
"Yes, of course. Set a thief to catch a thief. Dagon, before you settle him downstairs, bind him hand and foot with good iron chain. Pure iron, mind you. Gag and blindfold him."
He thought for a brief moment, tapping his lips with a finger.
"And cut off his thumbs."
"Yes, Your Grace."
Alvaron looked at me. "Do you think that should be sufficient?" I fought down a wave of nausea and forced myself not to wring my hands in my lap. I didn't know which I found more unsettling, the cheerful tone with which Alvaron delivered the commands or the flat, emotionless one with which Dagon accepted them. A full arcanist was nothing to trifle with, but I found the thought of crippling the man's hands more horrifying than killing him outright. Dagon left, and after the door closed, Stape shuddered.
"Good Lord, Rand! He's like cold water down the back of my neck. I wish you'd get rid of him."
The mayor laughed. "So someone else could have him? No, Stapes, I want him right here, my mad dog on a short leash." Stapes frowned, but before he could make anything more of it, his eyes were drawn through the doorway into the sitting room.
"Oh, there's another one."
He walked to the cage and returned with another dead flit, holding its tiny body tenderly as he carried it out of the chambers.
"I know you needed to test the medicine on something," he said from the other room, "but it's a little rough on the poor little Calanthus."
"Beg pardon?" I asked.
"Our Stapes is old-fashioned," Alvaron explained with a smile, "and more educated than he cares to admit. Calanthus is the Eldvintic name for them."
"I could swear I've heard that word somewhere else."
"It's also the surname of the royal line of Vintus," Alvaron said chidingly. "For someone who knows so much, you're curiously blind in places."
Stapes craned his neck to look toward the cage again.
"I know you had to do it," he said, "but why not use mice or Comptus de Fer's nasty little dog?"
Before I could answer, there was a thump from the outer rooms, and a guard burst through the inner door before Stapes could come to his feet.
"Your Grace,"
the man said breathlessly as he jumped to the room's only window and slammed the shutters. Next, he ran to the sitting room and did the same with the window in there. There followed other similar noises from rooms farther back I had never seen. There was a faint sound of furniture being moved. Stapes looked puzzled and half rose to his feet, but the mayor shook his head and motioned for him to sit down.
"Lieutenant,"
he called out, a tinge of irritation in his voice.
"Beg pardon, Your Grace,"
the guard said as he re-entered the room, breathing heavily.
"Dagon's orders. I was to secure your room straight away."
"I take it all is not well," Alvaron said dryly.
"There was no answer from the tower when we knocked. Dagon had us force the door. There was... I know not what it was, Your Grace. Some malignant spirit. And as he's dead, Your Grace, Codicus is nowhere in his rooms, but Dagon is after him."
Alvaron's expression darkened.
"Damn!"
he thundered, striking the arm of his chair with a fist. His brow furrowed, and he let out an explosive sigh.
"Very well."
He waved the guard away. The guard stood stiffly.
"Sir, Dagon said I'm not to leave you unguarded."
Alvaron gave him a dangerous look.
"Very well, but stand over there."
He pointed to the corner of the room. The guard appeared perfectly happy to fade into the background. Alvaron leaned forward, pressing the tips of his fingers to his forehead.
How in the name of God did he suspect?
The question seemed rhetorical, but it set the wheels of my mind spinning.
"Did Your Grace pick up his medicine yesterday?" "Yes, yes. I did everything the same as I had done in days past."
"Except you didn't send me to get your medicine," I thought to myself.
"Do you still have the vial?" I asked.
He did. Stapes brought it to me. I uncorked it and ran a finger along the inside of the glass.
"How does Your Grace's medicine taste?" "I've told you, brackish, bitter."
I watched the mayor's eyes go wide as I brought my finger to my mouth and touched it lightly to the tip of my tongue.
"Are you mad?"
Alvaron said incredulously.
"Sweet,"
I said simply. Then I rinsed my mouth with water and spat it as delicately as possible into an empty glass. I took a small folded packet of paper from a pocket in my vest, shook a small amount into my hand, and ate it, grimacing.
"What's that?"
Stapes asked. "Ligwellin," I lied, knowing the real answer, charcoal, would only provoke more questions. I took a mouthful of water and spat it out as well. This time, it was black, and Alvaron and Stapes stared at it, startled. I bowled ahead. Something must have made him suspect you were not taking your medicine, Your Grace. If it suddenly tasted different, you would have asked him. The mayor nodded. I saw him yesterday evening. He asked after my health. He beat his fist softly under the arm of his chair. All the cursed luck. If he has any wit, he's been gone half a day. We'll never catch him. I thought about reminding him that if he had believed me from the first, none of this would have happened, then thought better of it. I'd advise your men to stay out of his tower, Your Grace. He's had time to prepare a great deal of mischief in there, traps and the like. The mayor nodded and passed his hand in front of his eyes. Yes, of course. See to it, Stapes. I believe I'll take a bit of rest. This business may take a while to sort out. I gathered myself to leave, but the mayor gestured me back into my seat. Quoth, stay a moment and make me a pot of tea before you go. Stapes rang for servants. While clearing the remains of our lunch away, they glanced at me curiously. Not only sitting in the mayor's presence, I was sharing a meal with him in his private chambers. This news would be rumored through the estate in under 10 minutes. After the servants left, I made the mayor another pot of tea. I was preparing to leave when he spoke over the top of his cup, too softly for the guard to overhear. Quoth, you have proved perfectly trustworthy, and I regret any doubts I briefly entertained about you. He sipped and swallowed before continuing. Unfortunately, I cannot allow news of a poisoning to spread, especially with the poisoner escaped. He gave me a significant look. It would interfere with the matter we discussed before. I nodded. Widespread knowledge that his own arcanist had nearly killed him would hardly help Alvaron win the hand of the woman he hoped to marry. He continued. Unfortunately, this need for silence also precludes my giving you a reward you all too richly deserve. Were the situation different, I would consider the gift of lands mere token thanks. I would grant you title, too. This power my family still retains, free from the controlment of the king. My head reeled at the implication of what the mayor was saying as he continued. However, if I were to do such a thing, there would be need of explanation, and an explanation is the one thing I cannot afford. Alvaron extended his hand, and it took me a moment to realize he intended me to shake it. One does not typically shake hands with the mayor, Alvaron. I immediately regretted that the only person present to see it was the guard. I hoped he was a gossip. I took his hand solemnly, and Alvaron continued. I owe you a great debt. If you ever find yourself in need, you shall have at your command all the help a grateful lord can lend. I nodded graciously, trying to keep a calm demeanor despite my excitement. This was exactly what I had been hoping for. With the mayor's resources, I could make a concerted search for the Emir. He could get me access to monastery archives, private libraries, places where important documents hadn't been pruned and edited as they had in the university. But I knew this wasn't the proper time to ask. Alvaron had promised his help. I could simply bide my time and choose what type of help I wanted most. As I stepped outside the mayor's rooms, Stapes surprised me with a sudden, wordless embrace. The expression on his face couldn't have been more grateful if I'd pulled his family from a burning building.
Young sir, I doubt you understand how much I'm in your debt. If there's anything you ever need, just make me wise of it.
He gripped my hand, pumping it up and down enthusiastically. At the same time, I felt him press something into my palm. Then I was standing in the hallway. I opened my hand and saw a fine silver ring with Stapes's name etched across the face. Alongside it was a second ring that wasn't metal at all. It was smooth and white, and also had the manservant's name carved in rough letters across the surface of it. I had no idea what such a thing might signify. I made my way back to my rooms, almost dizzy with my sudden fortune. Chapter 65, A Beautiful Game. The next day my meager belongings were moved to rooms the mayor deemed more suitable for someone firmly in his favor. There were 5 of them in all, three with windows overlooking the garden. It was a nice gesture, but I couldn't help but think that these rooms were even farther from the kitchens. My food would be cold as a stone by the time it made its way to me. I'd barely been there an hour before a runner arrived bearing Braden's silver ring and a card that read, "Your glorious new rooms. When?" I turned the card over, wrote, "As soon as you like," and sent the boy on his way. I placed his silver ring on a tray in my sitting room. The bowl next to it now had two silver rings glittering among the iron. I opened the door to see Braden's dark eyes peering owlishly out at me from the halo of his white beard and hair. He smiled and bowed, his walking stick tucked under one arm. I offered him a seat, then excused myself politely and left him alone in the sitting room for a moment, as was the gracious thing to do. I was barely through the doorway before I heard his rich laugh coming from the other room.
"Ho, ho!" he said. "Now there's a thing."
When I returned, Braden was sitting by the tack board holding the two rings I had recently received from Stapes.
"This is certainly a turn for the books," he said. "Apparently I misjudged things yesterday when my runner was turned away from your door by an altogether surly guard."
I grinned at him. "It's been an exciting couple of days," I said. Braden tucked his chin and chuckled, looking even more owlish than usual.
"I dare say," he said, holding up the silver ring. "This tells quite a story. But this..."
He gestured to the white ring with his walking stick.
"This is something else entirely."
I pulled up a seat across from him. "I'll be frank with you," I said. "I can only guess what it's made of, let alone what it signifies." Braden raised an eyebrow.
"That's remarkably forthright of you."
I shrugged. "I feel somewhat more secure in my position here," I admitted. "Enough that I can be a little less guarded with the people who have been kind to me." He chuckled again as he laid the silver ring on the board.
"Secure," he said. "I dare say you are at that."
He picked up the white ring.
"Still, it's not odd that you wouldn't know about this."
"I thought there were just three types of rings," I said.
"That's true for the most part," Braden said. "But the giving of rings goes back quite a ways. The common folk were doing it long before it became a game for the gentry. And while Stapes may breathe the rarefied air with the rest of us, his family is undeniably common."
Braden set the white ring back onto the board and folded his hands over it.
"Those rings were made of things ordinary folk might find easily at hand. A young lover might give a ring of new green grass to someone he was courting. A ring of leather promises service, and so on."
"And a ring of horn?"
"A ring of horn shows enmity," Braden said. "Powerful and lasting enmity."
"Ah," I said, somewhat taken aback. "I see." Braden smiled and held the pale ring up to the light.
"But this," he said, "is not horn. The grain is wrong, and Stapes would never give a horn ring alongside a silver one."
He shook his head.
"No. Unless I miss my guess, this is a ring of bone."
He handed it to me. "Wonderful," I said glumly, turning it over in my hands. "And that means what? That he'll stab me in the liver and push me down a dry well?" Braden gave me his wide, warm smile.
"A ring of bone indicates a profound and lasting debt."
"I see." I rubbed it between my fingers. "I have to say I prefer being owed a favor."
"Not just a favor," Braden said. "Traditionally, a ring such as this is carved from the bone of a deceased family member."
He raised an eyebrow.
"And while I doubt that is currently the case, it does get the point across."
I looked up, still slightly dazed by it all. "And that is?"
"That these things are not given lightly. It's not a part of games the gentry play, and not the sort of ring you should display."
He gave me a look.
"If I were you, I'd tuck it safe away."
I put it carefully into my pocket.
"You've been such help," I said. "I wish I could repay..."
He held up a hand, cutting me off mid-sentence. Then, moving with solemn care,